Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, the former Syrian opposition head continues the cause. Syria's fragmented opposition suffers disarray.
The opposition remains very, very disunited and not presenting a convincing front.
Challenges facing Arab nations in the post-Arab Spring era. And Iran readies legal action against the film Argo. It's all ahead. Muaz al-Khatib, who resigned as head of the opposition Syrian National Coalition, said today he will still attend an Arab League meeting this week in Qatar. Khatib said he will deliver an address at the two-day summit in Doha. Arab diplomats said Sunday the Arab League had invited Khatib and interim Prime Minister Ghassan Hitto to represent Syria at the meeting. The Arab League suspended the Syrian government's membership of the bloc in 2011, and most members have called for President Bashar al-Assad's ouster. Khatib stepped down Sunday, complaining that the international community has not done enough to help the Syrian people defend themselves from Mr. Assad's forces. VOA correspondent Elizabeth Arrett has more on the story from our Middle East Bureau in Cairo.
Ahmed Muaz al-Khatib quit the presidency of the Syrian National Coalition Sunday, saying he would have more freedom to work outside any official institution. In a message on his Facebook page, Khatib said he had promised the Syrian people he would resign if matters reached what he described as some red lines. He did not immediately elaborate. Khatib was chosen to head the coalition only 4 months ago in an apparent move to unify the often fractious opposition. The resignation came as Qatar's foreign minister, Sheikh Hamad bin Jassim bin Jaber Al Thani, welcomed the coalition's election last week of Ghassan Hitto as prime minister of a shadow interim government. Sheikh Hamad called Hito's role an important and necessary step in preparing for Syria's interim period. The Sheikh was speaking in Doha ahead of an Arab summit Tuesday, where the Syrian conflict is expected to be high on the agenda. Syria's opposition has been deeply divided over the direction of the conflict, now in its third year. Some argue for dialogue with the government of President Bashar al-Assad, with others favoring a military solution. Among the latter are members of the Syrian Free Army, many of whom have also dismissed the idea of an interim opposition government. They argue rebel forces are already administering and governing the hard-fought areas under their control. Tensions between fighters on the ground and the Turkey-based opposition were heightened by Hito's perceived status as an outsider, in particular his U.S. citizenship. Carnegie Middle East Center Director Paul Salem says there have been problems with the opposition since the beginning, compounded now by the controversy surrounding the election of Hitto and the resignation of Khatib, which he calls an unfortunate development.
The opposition remains very, very disunited and not presenting a convincing front, neither to those inside Syria who are fighting, nor to the regional or international community which would want to help them.
Meanwhile, the European Union, which has supported the opposition politically, remained divided after a meeting Saturday with no decision taken over whether to lift an arms embargo, which would allow the delivery of weapons to the rebels. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
As many as 200,000 undocumented Syrian refugees are living outside the refugee camps in southern Turkey. Many don't have passports, and Turkish authorities are trying to register and look after them. But the undocumented refugees say aid is still scarce, and some are forced to live off the land. Patrick Wells reports from Kilis, Turkey.
Umsterfeser Al-Fadil, a Syrian mother of eight, gathers her bays, a leafy green vegetable, on the scrap of land she now inhabits outside Kilis in southern Turkey. This plant, which she will boil and feed to her children, is the only regular food her family has had since they fled government airstrikes a month ago. Umstef's family are among tens of thousands of Syrian refugees who have crossed into Turkey illegally. They spent their first 10 days here sleeping in a public park before finding this plot to rent. But their money has almost run out, and her sons cannot find work.
It's winter time and we don't know anybody here. That's why we can't find work.
She says she and her family miss home.
I wish we could just wake up tomorrow and go back to Syria. Syria is so beautiful.
Umstef's son-in-law, Ahmed Nassif, arrived in Turkey a few days ago after his children narrowly escaped an air raid. He said without a house or a job, he has no idea how he's going to look after them.
We don't have residence cards, so we only get a tiny bit of help. We hardly get any supplies here.
The plight of these refugees does not seem to improve with time. Ahmed Mustafa, a tailor, fled Syria 7 months ago. His family of 11 now live in two rooms above a stable, but he says they could be evicted at any time. Ahmed's children spent last winter without shoes, and none of them has a school to attend.
How do you think my life is now? I have 8 children and I lost my entire house. It's completely destroyed. There isn't even a glass left there to drink water from.
Turkey, with the support of UNHCR, is opening 10 coordination centers to register undocumented Syrians and distribute aid. So far, it has processed 50,000 people, but an additional 150,000 remain unregistered. Patrick Wells, VOA News, Kilis, southern Turkey.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has met Iraqi leaders in Baghdad to urge them to prevent Iran from flying weapons to the Syrian government through Iraqi airspace. Mr. Kerry told reporters that he had a spirited discussion on the issue with the Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki on Sunday. He said Iranian overflights are problematic because they sustain President Bashar al-Assad and his government.
And I made it very clear that for those of us who are engaged in an effort to see President Assad step down and to see a democratic process take hold, with a transitional government according to the Geneva Communique, for those of us engaged in that effort, anything that supports President Assad is problematic. And I made it very clear to the Prime Minister that the overflights from Iran are in fact helping to sustain President Assad and his regime. So we agreed to try to provide more information with respect to this, but I also made it clear to him that there are members of Congress and people in America who increasingly are watching what Iraq is doing and wondering how it is that a partner in the efforts for democracy and a partner for whom Americans feel they have tried so hard to be helpful, how that country can be in fact doing something that makes it more difficult to achieve our common goals, the goal expressed by the Prime Minister with respect to Syria and President Assad.
Washington accuses Tehran of sending planes on an almost daily basis to supply arms and fighters to Mr. Assad, a longtime Iranian ally. Iran has said it provides only humanitarian aid for Syria. Iraqis say they hope Sunday's visit to Baghdad by the U.S. Secretary of State will help revive ties they say have languished since the withdrawal of the last American troops more than a year ago. Scott Bobb has details from Baghdad in this report for VOA Television.
Iraqis reacted positively to the visit Sunday by Secretary of State John Kerry. In Baghdad's Karada district, coffee shop owner Raid Fahmi said stronger ties with the Americans would help Iraqis deal with their many problems.
The Iraqi people hope they can bring better security, jobs, electricity, clean water, things like that.
Singer Raid Fakhir noted that there have been clashes between Sunnis and Shiites in parts of Iraq, and bombings by Islamic extremists continue to kill Iraqi civilians. He was glad Kerry voiced concern over the violence.
The Americans can force Arab countries that are supporting the terrorists to stop their interference in Iraq, and they have the power to do it.
The U.S. withdrew the last of its combat troops from Iraq 15 months ago. A reporter for Al-Mada newspaper, Sarbar Al-Ta'i, said Iraqis have not forgotten the abuses during the 8-year occupation. But now, he says, U.S. involvement is needed to prevent abuses by the Iraqi government.
We have a million-man army now that is armed with American weapons. Maybe we need some support in intelligence and information, but not the military. We want the Americans now back politically on the Iraqi scene.
Kerry's visit was the first by an American Secretary of State in 4 years. Baghdad University professor Muntasir Idani says the U.S. needs to re-engage with Iraq in order to balance growing influence by regional powers like Turkey and Iran.
Iraqis don't receive signals about USA policy and international policy in Iraq. Iraqis say see only Iran signals in Iraq and Turkish intervention in Iraq. This is very dangerous.
He says more forceful U.S. diplomacy is also needed to address the Syrian conflict, which is aggravating Sunni-Shiite divisions across the Middle East. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Baghdad.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu late last week apologized to Turkey for a deadly naval raid in 2010 and announced a full resumption of diplomatic ties with Ankara. After the gesture, officials from both countries said diplomatic relations had been fully restored and that ambassadors would be reinstated. The diplomatic breakthrough was facilitated by U.S. President Barack Obama at the end of his 3-day visit to Israel. Gaith Al-Amari is executive director of the American Task Force on Palestine, and Nathan Sachs is a fellow at the Sabin Center of the Brookings Institution. VOA's Carol Castiel asks them about the changes in policy. First, Mr. Amari.
First of all, the actual conversation is something that came out of nowhere for those of us who are following the trip. We had no indication that that was going to be on the talking points and the issues to be discussed. So that was a surprise. And as to the conversation itself, you mentioned Netanyahu apologizing and promising compensation. On the other hand, Erdogan also decided to drop legal proceedings against Israeli commanders and what have you. So we are starting to see the beginning of a thaw in that relation. And it is a long overdue thaw. There are so many issues that are of not only mutual concern to Israel and Turkey, and I would say also by extension to Jordan, but these are issues of core importance to U.S. interest. Syria, how do you react to the developing situation in Syria? Iran, how can we have a united, coordinated policy on Iran? So all of these issues would require these two pillars of U.S. interest and U.S. alliance, Turkey and Israel, to work together along with other regional players. So that, if that is the only, if you wish, policy outcome, that is good enough.
Nathan Sachs, your reaction and its significance for the various issues that Gaith Al-Omari mentioned, not just the Israel-Turkish bilateral relationship, but also for Iran, Syria, and a number of other policy areas.
This is very big news. This is a huge success, and it's a real deliverable that the president brought back. Expectations were lowered so effectively by the White House that I think all of us were judging the visit on the public diplomacy realm. And as I said, I think it was a success in that realm, and it was already a good trip. But when news broke of the conversation and the apology and the resumption of relations, this really brought a true, tangible deliverable that will have real effect on the region. It's something the United States has wanted for a long time, of course. Turkey is an ally, it's a member of NATO. Israel is, of course, a very close ally of the United States. And the two countries had been allies, in fact, quite close allies in the military and intelligence realms, until the flotilla and a bit before that. The attempts to broker an apology and a thawing of the relationship were repeated. It had been ongoing for quite a while, and something similar to this had been on the table before, but was rejected for various different clauses by the parties. At one point, Israel considered it very seriously and pulled back. So this is a real success. An actual apology was something that Netanyahu was reluctant to do, and members of his inner cabinet were reluctant to prove earlier. The president managed to bring this about. And, of course, the reciprocity on the Turkish side. We need to see how this plays out in terms of actual close relationships. This is not just an issue of the flotilla. There may be deeper issues of domestic politics in Turkey and regional politics as well. But nonetheless, this is a very good sign, and both parties seem to be very much on board. So I think, as I said, before this announcement, it was a very successful trip. With this, it is even more so, and it's a true deliverable bringing back from the region, something that is very important, and it's really one of those rare situations in the Middle East where you have a win-win. It's good for Israel, it's good for Turkey, and it's very good for an ally of both, the United States.
Gaith Al-Omari, Executive Director of the American Task Force on Palestine, and Nathan Sachs, a fellow at the Sabin Center of the Brookings Institution, speaking with VOA's Carol Castiel on Encounter. 2 years after the Arab Spring uprisings began, many nations are still plagued by violence and unemployment, reports VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy. He has been investigating the issue and says economists believe for real change to take place, protests must be met with new economic policies. Besma Momani is an associate professor of political science at Waterloo University and a senior fellow at George Washington University. Our reporter asked about the challenges facing Arab nations in the post-revolution era.
Much of the challenge is to both generate jobs and to balance budgets. And obviously, after having so many years of declined economic activity in some countries, that's related to a direct drop of tourism, a lack of faith into the economy, the stock exchange, capital flight, foreign investors continue to be dissuaded from entering and investing in the Middle East. And so we see, unfortunately, a complete decline of income while the same expenses that were already quite high continuing to climb.
How does political reform or lack of impact the economic growth?
Well, we know that when countries are more liberal politically, it tends to mean that there's more economic growth. That's because countries that are prosperous politically tend to also promote entrepreneurship, tend to allow more investment into a country that generates jobs, that generates economic activity. And all of that, I think, signals a more positive economic outlook for many democratic countries. The challenge for the Middle East is that these are populist uprisings where many of the people are demanding not only economic justice, which they rightly deserve and have suffered for a very long time from non-inclusive economic growth, which means that many of these countries did not actually distribute that economic wealth beyond much of the economic elite. So it's a challenge in how to serve these countries by continuing the kinds of economic policies that meet the needs of the lowest poorest sectors of society, and at the same time continue to generate economic growth, which is an enormous challenge when, again, foreign investment and other capital-rich countries do not want to invest in these countries that seem to be unstable.
Where would the funds for economic growth come from when subsidies is a delicate social issue, tax revenues are limited, and international economy is too bad for donor countries?
That's exactly the dilemma. I mean, you know, internationally, the entire economy is somewhat at a standstill. There is some view that perhaps some of this wealth and investment could come from the so-called BRICS, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, or the emerging market economies. For the Middle East, that tends to be sort of Turkish investment because Turkey is still very much capital rich, similarly some of the Gulf countries. But even there, trying to attract these corporations and governments to invest in the Middle East has been quite problematic because the political instability continues to dissuade investment. Now, I think we do see also a backlash, unfortunately, within some of these countries against some of these Gulf investors. There's always this view that somehow they come with political agendas. So that's also dissuading many Gulf investors from taking on investment projects in the Middle East proper.
How differently should the IMF deal with loans to these countries? Because in the past, IMF loans came with strings that caused uproar.
Well, I think the IMF has changed significantly from the previous time when much of the kinds of structural adjustment policies that were so unfavorable and so mismanaged. Now we see the International Monetary Fund trying to promote a balanced budget, which, again, at the end of the day, is required of any country to spend not more than it makes, which continues to be the problem for much of the Middle East, but also to ensure that the, again, lowest socioeconomic sectors are protected, that we see a redistribution of income equitably that still promotes the kind of economic growth that is required for a modern economy. And at the end of the day, Like it or not, we are interdependent, and global capital is quite fluid, and we cannot continue to think that any economy is isolated from the other and promote policies that are somehow going to, I think, lead to the kind of capital flight that unfortunately would bring down any economy.
How could the Arab governments going through transition deal with the subsidies lifting, which may cause social unrest?
I think very carefully, and much of the subsidies have been, I think, misallocated. Unfortunately, in some countries, the subsidies are universal subsidies, and so not only do the poor get it, which deserve and need the subsidies, but we also see many of the rich benefiting from particularly fuel subsidies and food subsidies, which do not need to cater to the elite class. So it needs to be targeted subsidies, ensure that the poorest sectors of societies receive those subsidies, and at the same time, I think, promoting the kind of sound economic policies that, again, we cannot continue to spend more than we make, and that, unfortunately, has continued throughout many parts of the region.
Besma Mamoni, a professor at Waterloo University and a senior fellow at George Washington University. A high-profile French lawyer says Iran will soon take legal action in Europe and the United States against the Academy Award-winning movie Argo for what Iran alleges is deliberately falsifying history and misrepresenting Iran. The lawyer spoke with reporter Lisa Bryant in Paris.
Is it a Hollywood blockbuster only loosely based on fact or a smear campaign against Iran? French lawyer Isabelle Coutant-Père says the Islamic Republic believes the American movie Argo deliberately aims to blind its audience through a twisted portrayal of Iran and Iranians.
On m'a demandé, le ministre de la Culture d'Iran, de la République d'Iran, m'a demandé.
In a telephone interview, Coutant-Père says the Iranian culture minister asked her to engage in what she calls useful legal procedures against the film's distributors and makers. She says that could happen in a matter of weeks, both in Europe and the United States.
Le peuple iranien est montré de manière très vulgaire comme constitué de fous violents, hystériques.
Coutant-Père says Argo depicts Iranians as crazy, violent, and hysterical, which does not at all correspond to the country's ancient culture and civilization. She says it is a Hollywood production with good guys and bad guys, very much, she says, like U.S. foreign policy. Representatives of Warner Brothers, which distributed the film, have said they have no comment on any Iranian legal moves. The studio did not return calls from VOA. Argo is based on the 1979 American embassy hostage crisis in Iran. That was more than 30 years ago. Today, Iran and the international community are at loggerheads over Tehran's nuclear program. Iran claims it is for peaceful purposes, but Western nations fear the country is trying to build a nuclear bomb.
La France, c'est un endroit important, et donc pour eux, c'est un signe fort qu'on puisse faire un procès ici.
Coutant-Père says France would be a good place to file suit against Argo's local distributor because France once sheltered Iranian revolutionary leader Ayatollah Khomeini. She says Iran also wants to start legal proceedings against the movie's producer and director in the United States. She says Argo is one of several Hollywood productions that have what she calls a strategy of aggression against Iran. Coutant-Père has a reputation for taking on controversial clients. She defended and also married Venezuelan terrorist Elik Ramirez Sanchez, better known as Carlos the Jackal. He is serving a life sentence in France for deadly attacks in the 1980s. Iran is hardly the first to question Argo's accuracy. Both former U.S. President Jimmy Carter and ex-Canadian Ambassador Ken Taylor say elements of the film stray far from historical accuracy. And New Zealand's parliament has expressed dismay at its portrayal of Kiwis in Tehran as refusing to help the American hostages. Argo's makers have previously acknowledged they took liberties with history.
Ce qui compte, c'est que les gens soient éclairés soit éclairé sur le fait qu'il y a un débat.
Coutant-Père suggests that Iran knows it has little chance of winning a case against the movie. What's important, she says, is to launch a debate about the film and to show the real face of Iran. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.